So this morning we're going to talk about electrifying buildings and climate justice, which I've been told you guys would be interested in this, so I hope you find it interesting. I'm going to go off script a little bit. I actually was debating whether or not to come. My wife and I had a newborn 9 days ago. Have a 6.5-year-old named Nash Cooper Baird. We named him after Diane Nash, who was a leader in the African American Civil Rights Movement. Diane Nash, and this is relevant to my talk, she was the chairwoman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that was fighting for black people and women to get the right to vote in America in 1963. So she was a college student, she was 22. She was a beauty pageant winner, and she dropped out of Fisk University, along with Congressman John Lewis, former Mayor Marion Barry, Andrew Young, and a bunch of other leaders, and they formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was like the left wing to Dr. Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And one of the first campaigns that they decided to do was the sit-ins, which worked. They totally desegregated downtown Nashville, and they're like, what are we going to do next? So the next thing they decided to do is they're going to desegregate the busing system. And so as buses, Greyhound buses, like cross state lines from like Tennessee into Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia, like they would like ask all the black people to get up and move to the back of the bus or even get off the bus if there weren't any seats. And so the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, this group of college kids, decided that they were going to segregate busing in America. And so Congressman John Lewis, future Congressman John Lewis, was one of the first people on the bus, or on the first wave of buses that they were going to segregate, and like basically pulled into Alabama, they threw like a bomb into the bus, you know, beat the hell out of everybody, sent everybody to the hospital. And Diane Nash was the chairwoman of the organization who got the phone call, hey, John Lewis and the other guys just got the shit beat out of him in Alabama. What do you want to do? Should we call off this campaign? And she said, well, we're all going to get on the next bus down. They're just going to have to beat us up too. And she was just an incredibly courageous woman. Another story that I found really inspirational was when she was 8 months pregnant, she was working with Dr. King to try to win African Americans the right to vote in Alabama. And she was arrested, I think by Sheriff Jim Clark. And so, you know, she was going into the judge to get sentenced and go to jail, and the judge was kind of like, well, look, like, if you, like, plead guilty to, you know, rounding up local Negroes in Alabama, we'll, like, let you off the hook and we won't send you to jail because you're 8 months pregnant, so, you know, just plead guilty and, like, we'll kind of let it go. She was like, no, absolutely, throw me in jail. I'll give birth to my kid in jail. I believe in what we're doing. And she's just my personal hero, so we named our son after her. So we had our second kid, Nova, Nova Don, a week or so ago, and everything went well. But you know, she was 3 weeks early, and we are watching her wait. And I had to think about whether or not it made sense for me to break paternity leave and come. And so I'd actually talked to the organizers about, like, maybe not coming or a virtual presentation because I want to be with my family. And then yesterday we actually got the difficult news from the pediatrician that there was like a genetics test that our kid took, and our kid might have some like life-threatening disease or something. She probably doesn't have it. It's 99.7% false positive test. But any parent that gets difficult news about your kid, like, you're kind of on pause. Yet I'm still here. And so why is that? Why did I think it was actually important to, like, leave my wife, leave my six-year-old, leave my newborn who may have a genetic disorder? When I walk out and I get into the car and I dial into the genetics office to virtually consult, it's because I think this industry is important. And I think that the work that you guys do is important. And I'm here to listen and learn and share some of the things that I've been learning, and hopefully use the last 10 to 15 minutes of the session to hear from you all about the obstacles that you're seeing in your work, so we can, like, go to the White House and share it with other people and unblock those obstacles. That's why I'm here. My kid's probably fine. My 6.5-year-old is totally fine. But in 10 years, things will not be fine, right? The latest climate report came out yesterday. All of the anguish that I feel today about what may or may not be happening with my newborn, our kids are all gonna feel that. Our grandkids will have that for their entire life. All of the depression and anxiety and quiet rage and frustration that we've all felt in this pandemic together, we will all feel that. Our kids will have that forever. Our grandkids will have that forever unless dramatic changes are made. And I personally believe that it is the green buildings industry that will lead our way out of this. So that's why I'm here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, with that as context, let's get into it. I think that in our industry or in our business, what we talk about is we look at the hardest to serve medium-sized buildings. A lot of you may work with like corporations that own skyscrapers and operate them, and they may have a chief sustainability officer who comes in and hires you for your expertise, and they have budget and they have professionals on staff. But we know there's 5 million buildings across the country that are like churches and synagogues and mosques, small businesses, and they don't have a budget for a sustainability officer. They may not have a budget to hire you guys to come in and provide them advice on how they can get LEED certified. These buildings waste about $100 billion per year on fossil fuels, that they pay for the fossil fuels and then they like waste it. And that's on top of fossil fuels that they consume that they actually do use. And so our view is that we can turn these 5 million buildings into Teslas. We can make them electric buildings, we can make them smart buildings, we can make them healthier buildings with no fossil fuels. We can do that today with no additional inventions and hardware or software that are needed. And second, we believe that we can do this in communities that need environmental justice. And we think that's important. Not just because it's the fucking right thing to do, who cares, right? Because we're past that. Because none of us will have climate policy or legislation in America until Senator Manchin votes for it. And if our industry and the clean energy industry more broadly has spent the last 10 years investing in clean energy jobs, manufacturing, installation in West Virginia, then maybe we have climate policy for all of us today. But we did not do that, and so we do not have it. So I am not a person that talks about climate justice as like a nice to have. If we do not have climate justice, we will not have national climate policy, because we will not have the votes that we need in the United States Senate or the Congress to pass climate policy. We will not be able to have the federal government support state governments in having massive interventions that the United Nations scientists are all saying that we need. So that's my premise. That's where I start, and that's kind of where we're gonna go in this talk. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. So really quick, we'll race through this. So, you know, waste $100 billion of energy. I think during the pandemic, this became more important. If you're in the pandemic in an apartment building, like where me and my family live in Brooklyn, and you're worried about COVID spreading apartment buildings, or you're sending your kid to school and you're worried about COVID spreading classroom, everyone became more and more focused on the health impacts of the buildings, which I think is really important. And of course, these 5 million buildings are 7% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. You guys know it's 30% for buildings overall. We think it's a massive business opportunity. And we think that the problem is you guys know better than anybody, these projects are super complex, they're super manual, they're super expensive, right? And I think in many ways, you guys are the solution for folks who can afford to bring you in to manage all of the complexity of negotiating with electrical engineer and chemical engineer and a general contractor, talking to Mitsubishi about the size of the heat pump. If projects need to be financed, you guys know that the engineering report and the construction report need to be combined and then turned into a financial report where the underwriting of the pro forma financial analysis of the building needs to occur, then the bank provides capital. Then if you do all of that, you go to the government to get your local permit or incentive. And then in the case of electrifying buildings, you also have to go to the electric utility to get an electrification permit. So all stuff's too complicated for mom and pop or pastors or rabbis or imams who run medium-sized buildings to manage. So part of what we want to do today is try to challenge you guys a little bit to think about how we can all work together to resolve this and, you know, literally save the planet. One of the things that's interesting is there's a cycle of energy poverty in low-income buildings. They can't afford to retrofit the buildings, so they waste more energy per square foot. And the buildings are hyper-inefficient, and so you'll see like this bell curve where you have like low-income buildings and hyper-affluent buildings, like indoor swimming pool or whatever. And those are the two buildings that like waste the most energy per square foot. But the low-income buildings don't have any money to fix it. Their energy bills are super high. As they pay those energy bills, they have less money to invest in CapEx. So it's actually a cycle of not having money, not being able to make investments, high energy costs. And what's relevant is the energy cost can be as high as 20 to 30% of the total operating budget. What got me interested in this problem was I was working as a consultant to the Obama administration, to the Department of Energy and the weatherization programs. One of my favorite pastors in Brooklyn called me and said, "Hey, my church only makes $300,000 of revenue a year, and $120,000 of that goes to my energy bill." And so he's interested in saving the planet and being a steward of God's creation, but he's trying to figure out, 30% of every dollar he takes in goes to his energy bill. That's a very different kind of relationship to energy, right? And we believe that there's millions and millions of buildings across the country that have that. So at BlockPower, what we've done is to try to digitize this. We've gotten some tough lessons from Silicon Valley about what's possible. We think that mobile computing, cloud computing, the collapse in the cost of machine learning speed. Any college kid at the 40 colleges in Boston, they all learn about machine learning and computer science 101. It didn't used to be that way. And so now that we have the power of these new computational platforms, we believe that's going to massively impact the way that we can analyze and score and finance and upgrade green buildings across America. So we built a platform that does it. This is how we do it. We built a software platform. We build energy plus models of every building that we do. We have a new project with Jeff Bezos where we have data on 125 million buildings across America. We're providing free digital energy models of all the buildings. And so every building in America will have a score. We will provide it an electric building's feasibility plan. You can kind of search for your building, type in the address, and get kind of like a free plan, which hopefully that building owner will take and review and like bring to you guys to try to implement. So that's what we do. More interesting than that, this is a relevant slide to you. So I think the fact that we can build software to help us optimize green building processes, and we spoke a bit about how you guys are prioritizing your online work and the efficiencies that come from that, that allows us to, if we can unlock software to analyze those buildings really quickly, then we can use that data and those insights to partner with local women, minority, veteran-owned construction firms and train them to come in and do green construction to implement projects that our software identifies for millions of buildings. That's our fundamental hypothesis, and that's what I would challenge some of you guys around today. So, we are, as a company, are creating the dangerous urban building infrastructure of America. That's what we're about. Here's why we think this matters. We touched on it briefly. The Bronx has the highest asthma rates in the United States, chronic childhood asthma. It has the poorest congressional district in the country. 20% of the kids in the Bronx have chronic asthma. Now, that is partially because the Bronx hosts a regional food distribution system where all of the food that goes in all the grocery stores in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey runs through the Bronx, so there's all these 18-wheeler trucks that come through and pollute everything. But it's partially because all the buildings in the Bronx suck the pollution from the trucks and then recirculate it in the building, and that there's 5,000 giant apartment buildings in the Bronx that burn oil for heat and for hot water every single day. And so those are the reasons that the Bronx has the highest asthma rates in the country. Now we saw, this is moderate, I've seen a lot worse. I've actually seen a coal burning boiler that was upgraded to burn oil that we replaced. This is a moderate, crappy boiler system. Now, this became relevant once asthma was seen to be a comorbidity for COVID, not only in the Bronx, but across America. And so the argument that I'm making is that unhealthy buildings and buildings that are not green have huge societal impact. And I think we're in a moment where more people than just us at USGBC understand that. And the question for all of us is, what are we going to do with that moment? And can we seize it? Does that kind of make sense? All right. One of the things I want to push you guys to think about a little bit and respond to with our remaining time is, what does it look like to think about a joint environmental justice or climate justice campaign? What does it look like? We have a president who's committed to Justice 40. Do people know what Justice 40 is? Kind of, not really. Justice 40 is a commitment from the Biden administration that 40% of every single dollar that the federal government spends on infrastructure and climate will go into low-income communities in need of justice and environmental justice. 40% of all of the money that the Biden administration spends through HUD, right, through the Department of Agriculture, through Commerce, through the Department of Energy, 40% of all of the money is supposed to go to low-income communities. The bipartisan infrastructure bill is over $1 trillion. 40% of that, through presidential executive order, is supposed to go and be invested in low-income communities. It's a massive amount of money. We had a chance to meet with Senator Manchin, I was mentioning this morning, we had a chance to meet with Senator Manchin in D.C. a couple weeks ago, and he was like, look guys, you're from the private sector, I'm telling you, we're gonna do a deal. We're like, really? He's like, yeah, we're gonna open up, reopen negotiations, we're gonna do a climate deal. It's gonna have nuclear, it's gonna have green hydrogen, you know, it's gonna have a bunch of stuff in there that I may not agree with, but we gotta take what we can get. And we think that bill is gonna be $555 billion. 40% of that $555 billion is gonna go to be invested in low-income community. What a massive opportunity for USGBC to lead the way on partnering with the Biden-Harris administration and partnering with folks on the ground who are going to be thinking about how to implement that money, where it should go, and what kind of impact it might have not only on green buildings and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but creating local jobs, improving the health of local buildings across America. Like, the time is now. So I want to challenge you guys to think about, like, what might it look like for us to have our chapters partner with, for example, weatherization providers. You guys know the Weatherization Assistance Program? Permit? Some of us? Weatherization Assistance Program was created in 1976 by President Carter. Remember, he like put on a sweater and then he was like, America needs to turn the thermostat down, and he was unelected. Now everybody's Joe Biden's in a similar situation. Anyway, he created this program called the Weatherization Assistance Program in 1976 that, you know, there's like something like a couple $1 billion a year that goes out to local nonprofits as part of the Black Power movement. Black communities negotiated with the federal government to have direct investment in local community-controlled nonprofits. And the Weatherization Assistance Program is part of that. And so there's these local nonprofits throughout America, Black communities, white communities, brown communities, and they receive federal funding directly to go around and weatherize low-income buildings. And traditionally what that means is like window replacements, wrapping pipes and boilers. Sometimes they get into more complicated stuff, replacing HVAC or hot water. We're trying to get them to electrify. That program got $3.2 billion earlier this week or last week. And so there's a bunch of nonprofits across America that just got 10 times the money that they received last year to do green buildings. And they're all over America. What if the US Green Building Council, what if we partnered with the weatherization providers across America and said, look, we're gonna figure this out. We're gonna find a way to help you guys implement projects, Maybe we can't do all of them, and we can't donate all of our time, but, you know, maybe we all commit to, like, we're going to electrify our house, we're going to electrify our kids' school, we're going to electrify our place of worship. So we're all going to figure out how to low bono or pro bono work with our local weatherization providers. Again, they do have billions of dollars, so they could hire you to do it, but for purposes of speed, it may make sense to do some initial demonstration projects. How might we partner with them to help them implement electric buildings projects or green buildings projects across America and capture that on video, capture the data, make case studies, account for how many local jobs we create, figure out how we can train local people, maybe it's ex-offenders, people who age out of foster care, folks from vulnerable populations who are very excited about green buildings industry, from what I can tell. What does it look like to partner and think about that? So that's one part. We had this crazy project 6 months ago where the White House and the City Hall in New York City were like, hey, we have like $40 million of COVID relief money, and it is to prevent gun violence. There's like a wave of gun violence across America during the pandemic, because everybody's like, well, I won't characterize that. Anyway, there's a wave of gun violence across America, and in New York, it's particularly acute. And so City Hall called my firm and said, could you guys hire 800 people that the NYPD, the police, have identified as likely to be involved in future incidents of gun violence? I was like, what the fuck does that mean? And they were like, well, they're like, there's this like gang in public housing. It's like 54 guys, and they're like part of this street gang. They like deal drugs, and you know, they're gonna like shoot everybody and deal drugs. But if we hire them, the leader of the gang said he'll like shut down the street gang, they'll all stop dealing drugs, and they'll all like work for $25 an hour. And I was like, what? So we met with the leader of the street gang, we're like, well, what are you guys gonna do? And you know, we can train you on how to electrify buildings. Like, we'll rip out fossil fuels, we'll remove lead and mold and asbestos, we'll train you how to put in solar panels, we'll train you how to put in heat pumps, EV charging stations, like, how does that sound? He's like, great, we're gonna shut down the whole gang, we're ready to go. And we're like, great, the training's gonna be, you know, it's gonna start next week, it's gonna be located here. He's like, we can't go there because there's a rival gang, that's their territory, but we'll have the training in our territory. Ooh, so we trained that. So we had trained and hired 800 vulnerable people impacted by gun violence in New York City. On how to green buildings. These are the neighborhoods that they're from. These are some of the folks. I was trying to do this thing where I was like, oh, we hired 1,000 George Floyds. People don't like that, but I think it's true. Like, these are vulnerable people who are impacted by gun violence and don't have stable work. And we have trained and hired them and brought them into the green construction industry. Now, what we've been learning by doing that is that it's created an enormous set of opportunities for us that are business opportunities that put more money in our pocket while we are doing the right thing for climate justice. I think that's the central point I want to make here as I wrap. Like, here, this is Rikers Island. Rikers Island is where everybody goes to jail in New York. It's horrible. Like, there's a video of like some like fight club that the securities guard set up. It's a terrible place. These workers, these five workers, have all been, I don't know if they're fucking Rikers Island, but these workers have been there. They have family members who are in Rikers Island, or they have been locked up in Rikers Island themselves. So we trained them to do a solar carport on Rikers Island, and it was really powerful for them. You know, they're like, look, last time I was here, this is my dad who was locked up. Now I'm here, I have a job, I learned how to do solar panels. Here we're electrifying a church in Queens. So it had an oil burning system, we're putting in all the electric heat pumps. There's a gentleman who worked in that project who was incarcerated for 17 years and was just released, was ready to work. And we paired him with a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan who we trained on building electrification. They work side by side, they're a great team. Everything's great. Here we're installing with our workforce community and broadband to help close the digital divide, which we all see how acute and terrible that's been for kids across America if they cannot afford high-quality internet access. So there's rooftop internet. I mean, Verizon doesn't want you to to know this, but like you can put like rooftop, low cost, cheap microwave mesh internet on roofs of buildings and provide like low cost. So if we provide internet for like $10 a month, it's like faster than what the cable companies provide. And so we're able to hook up like 100,000 people to the internet in the Bronx with work report. So there's 1,200 people that we've trained. There's about 800 that continue to be employed by us right now. We train them on OSHA so that they have their construction and job safety certifications. And gun violence has been reduced by 30% in the neighborhoods that we're targeting. It's great. So, what I want to challenge you guys on with our remaining time is, I think that the social, the health, the pediatric health, the environmental benefits, the energy saving benefits of these projects in low-income communities is actually higher, and it's a more interesting story for local media, and I want you guys to think about it as a way of generating business. So what does it look like to think about, again, like a national network of nonprofits? They have no idea what they're doing. They have no technical expertise whatsoever. They need your help to figure out how to deploy and invest $3 billion pretty rapidly. I mean, just to be blunt, the Democrats are worried they're going to lose control of Congress, so there's a lot of pressure to put this money out into green buildings projects that can create local wins so that local Democratic congressmen can, like, you know, whatever. I don't know how political you guys get here, but there's a lot of pressure on these nonprofits to green low-income buildings, and I think that you guys would make a really interesting partner for them. And I hope that by sharing the stories of some of these workers and some of these projects, you can see the kind of impact that you can have locally and nationally, and that I believe that impact will translate into increased revenue opportunities and increased new opportunities to green more buildings, which is what I know you guys are all about.
Donnell, thank you so much for those remarks, and thank you for being here. I appreciate how important you think we are to give of yourself today. So overall, who am I? Why am I talking to you? I am USGBC's head of US Market Transformation and Development. I am really happy to be here with you today. I want to give you all a really big thank you. I know that these are challenging times, and you may or may not realize what a momentous day this is for the USGBC community. A little more than 2 years ago, USGBC sent its staff home, canceled travel, and canceled all events to flatten the curve. We thought we'd return in just a couple weeks, and meanwhile, we are here, 2 years plus, which is a long time, hosting our first in-person event since. An organization focused upon the built environment left the building. My built environment for 2 years, like so many of yours, shrunk to my home, the data center that supplied my connection to the world, the grocery store, and my son's Lee Gold Elementary School. It is worth noting that that same Lee Gold Elementary School has posted some of the lowest COVID rates across Washington, D.C. It further bolstered my belief that the work we do is important. So while challenged, the USGBC community did not retreat. We persevered. We saw tens of thousands of people virtual, people we were never able to see in person. We saw them in things from digital thought leadership panels to green building tours to building case studies, to celebrate the incredible projects and people that continue to achieve. There have been silver linings in all of this, however. My neighbors now casually talk about IAQ, and I never believed that anybody was going to talk about a MERV air filter all the time, all day, every day. So, while we're on me and I'm talking a little bit about me, let's talk a bit more. I'm a native Vermonter, and I did what a lot of rural New Englanders do. I came to Boston to go to college. The neighborhood we're all in right now, and I'll date myself very quickly, did not exist in the mid to late 90s. This is a testament to the advancements in the pace in our built environment. Worth noting, this neighborhood is loaded with LEED buildings. You can literally throw a rock and hit one. Boston has and continues to be a place of leadership, innovation, and achievement, both overall and for the green building movement. So it makes sense that we're here with you today. We're here in Boston for our first in-person event in 2 years because this is a place of importance. This is the home of some of our strongest rebuilds, some of our first by way of projects, by way of people, and leadership moments. Our community is strong. Our community is excited. excited to be back together. One USGBC, one USGBC community. So how do we get things done and ensure continued and future success? We partner and we do the work. We continue to place our stakeholders first. We build the market together. Here in Massachusetts, we have an incredible partner. Meredith is here with us today. Thank you to everybody that participates with Built Environment Plus. We're grateful for the continued excellence that Built Environment Plus brings to the leadership market and excited for what the future looks like when we work together. As we continue on our path to engage with our community through USGBC Live events, worth noting, coming to the Twin Cities of Washington, D.C. soon, we are going to listen, educate, and celebrate our collective achievements. We're going to continuously iterate our conversations, our events, our engagements, and ensure that we're meeting the needs and the expectations of the market and our supporters, all of you. We're going to work to ensure that we're hearing from the voices that are unknown to us. We talk to ourselves a lot. We're going to celebrate the past while focusing on creating a more inclusive future. Now, before I go on too long, it's worth noting I am stuck between a keynote and a networking break. That is a tough position. I really want to encourage you when you do go to break to talk to and enjoy the people around you. Think of the people that aren't here and those folks that we need to be engaging and bringing to the next event, the next meeting, the next digital something. USGBC is your organization. With that, enjoy USGBC Live or Boston Forum, and thank you.